From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, May the 1st, 2020, and we have a interesting show lined up for you today. I do believe we're going to be talking first with Amy Stevenson. She has a degree in microbiology and wrote an essay this week on that appeared on the Ethan Allen Institute's website talking about how Vermont probably should open up its economy. We are, she thinks, have largely avoided the worst of this coronavirus pandemic, and we should be realizing that and getting the economy back in shape to the extent we can. And so we'll be hearing from her just in a couple of minutes after I tell you what else is coming up later on the show. We have we're going to be talking with Bob Ney after the middle of the show. He's a regular on Fridays these days, one of our longtime national correspondents, and I really enjoy talking with Bob. He is he's got a lot on the ball and just always has interesting insights to share. In the interim, we're also going to be talking in the second half hour of the program today. Another very interesting conversation, I think, and one which may draw some listener calls. Michael Harrington, the commissioner of the Vermont Department of Labor, is going to be joining us, and he's going to be updating us on the situation with our state's unemployment system and its difficulty processing the huge influx of claims it has received in recent weeks. And then the longer segment later in the show, we're going to be talking with the three people involved in the judiciary system in Vermont. Judge Brian Grierson is the chief administrative judge for the state. Patricia Gable is the court administrator. And, of course, we'll have Dan Richardson with us. He's a favorite of the Dave Graham Show here. He's our regular legal analyst and frequently talks to us about what's going on in the courts and in the legal profession and all. And so we'll be talking with the three of them about sort of how the courts are limping along right now, doing what they absolutely have to do, but putting off a lot of their more routine work, and what that'll mean when things finally sort of return to normal, and how they are planning for what is expected to be a huge influx of business just as things open back up again in Vermont's court system. So that should be an interesting conversation as well. And lastly, I'll have a little, perhaps a word or two at the end of the show about an exchange we got into yesterday that I frankly kind of regret now. We'll fill you in on the details later. So let's start right in here with Amy Stevenson. She is a first-time guest on the Dave Graham Show. I believe she is on the phone with us. And good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And you are a microbiologist by training. I'm told that you work at the Community College of Vermont, but are not speaking in behalf of your employer here. This is all your personal thinking about Vermont's response to the COVID-19 crisis. You had an interesting essay on the Ethan Allen's website, Ethan Allen Institute's website this week. Tell us a little bit about just the main points you were trying to make.
Well, I would say that, I feel like the time has come to really open up Vermont and not, I don't know that it is to our benefit to keep doing it in such a slow fashion. I'm also concerned about, using data to make decisions only if we have real data and, the trouble that we've gotten into by using models. Essentially, the main thesis of the editorial was that the rationale for shutting down Vermont and putting everybody in this lockdown was to flatten the curve. I mean, it's not different from anywhere else, in the United States or around the world. It was about hospital capacity and can we care for the sick? And it was preparing mm-hmm. for, this big tidal wave of COVID patients. Well, it turns out that that tidal wave did not happen. And we don't have a hospital capacity issue. Even the state's own modeling efforts, at this point in time are predicting worst case scenario, 200 beds are needed for COVID patients. And we have 856 beds in the state. In fact, since this began, we have increased hospital capacity. So since hospital capacity is not an issue, why are we not opening up now? Why are they changing the reasons for why we're not opening up. I mean, I know we're opening up a little, but it's very slow, and it's not also very, it's not clear what data they are making their decisions on now, not that they were using data to begin with.
The the modeling back in, say, a month ago or so was described as quite worrisome, and we were expected to hit a sort of peak in the latter part of April, I do believe. And and one of the things that I was hearing, sort of the subtexts that would come up occasionally in briefings here at the state level and also at the national level from some folks, was that if you take steps to do social distancing, a lot of which unfortunately did involve closing businesses and basically telling people to stay home and so on and so forth, you had a chance to kind of beat this thing and to make and to keep the overwhelmed healthcare system from occurring, let's say, as one aspect, one big aspect of this thing. I wonder if we're in a weird situation here where we have a case of success disproves the case, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I also think that since these were the models were so wildly inaccurate to begin with, it doesn't make sense to keep sticking to those models as the justification for the lockdown. In fact, I would also argue that it's really important for all Vermonters that we, have the lockdown end soon so that we can, and abruptly, so we can develop herd immunity. I mean, I would make a couple points about that. Herd immunity is essentially when we have passed the virus around enough that when it enters someone new, it ends up not being able to find new hosts, essentially. They're all dead ends because people have had it already and they developed immunity. So if we don't mm-hmm. have a certain percentage of the population that have been, that we've gotten to that point of herd immunity, this idea that we wait for a vaccine is just ludicrous because, first of all, the timeline of a vaccine, it's just unsustainable to think we'd stay shut down until there's a vaccine. And then second of all, I mean, look at how many people actually get vaccinated for the flu. I mean, it's not a large percentage or it's, I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but what are we going to hold people down and force them to get the vaccine for COVID? The lockdown is just, it's not preventing, coronavirus spread through the population. It's just slowing it down. So by keeping Vermont on lockdown, we're just pushing off the inevitable. And I think that's to the extreme detriment of all Vermonters, not just, some. I think we need to have a plan in opening up where we're strategic about protecting the vulnerable. We are focusing our testing and, our social isolation on the vulnerable. But the rest of us, can go about business as usual and help, especially kids who aren't impacted by this, and develop herd immunity. I mean, we know the vast majority, now it's a very different state than when the lockdown was put in place. It was an unknown back then. Now we know that the vast majority of people are only mildly impacted by this virus, if they even notice that they had it. And that there's, a subset of the population of the elderly and the immunocompromised that are vulnerable. So we're in a very different position now than we were, a couple months ago in mid-March.
You said in your essay that the purpose of social distancing is to spread out cases, preventing hospitals from being overwhelmed, and in turn avoiding deaths from COVID due to the lack of available medical care. And certainly that was one big reason given. I mean, there was a lot of talk of this flattening the curve and wanting not to overwhelm our healthcare system. What I'm hearing from folks in the healthcare system is that there is concern now for actually the fiscal health of a lot of our hospitals, because one reason for that, some of them were struggling already, but one reason for the new worry is that they have been putting off basically money-making procedures known as elective surgeries, and that many of them have been really therefore losing out on a lot of revenue the last couple of months. Is it your sense that the hospitals are ready now or should be ready to kind of resume normal operations?
you know, I don't know that I have a sense of the hospitals. I just do. I do know that they've had to furlough workers, which, you know, is not a good situation. Obviously, you don't have a hospital capacity issue if you have to lay off a lot of your staff. And I would also say that there's a good argument to be made that a lot of these so-called elective surgeries aren't so elective. I mean, if you have cancer, do you consider that elective to have, you know, a surgery to remove, say, a mole that they've said, you know, is melanoma? If you
let me stop you there and ask you, have you heard that said that cancer? I mean, what I heard about elective surgeries was that there was a range and a sort of judgment call to be made about what was considered emergent and what was considered elective. And I would imagine that somebody who actually had been diagnosed with cancer and scheduled for surgery would still have been on the schedule to get that surgery, no?
I don't, you know, this is getting a little bit out of areas that I have researched, but anecdotally, I have heard folks that have had to fight. I mean, there was a story on VPR, I think, about a guy who had to fight pretty hard to get his surgery back on the schedule because he didn't feel it was elective at all. I think it was around prostate cancer. You know, I've also heard anecdotally that, you know, some people have passed away from not having the surgery they needed. So, you know, elective is a judgment call. And whose judgment is that to say, you know, the potential that this person might get COVID is more important than you getting this surgery that you may think is, you know, really important for your health and well-being and even your life?
Yeah. One of the things that I'm also hearing about concerns for a possible resurgence of COVID-19 in Vermont is that some of our neighboring states have far more cases than we do and far more deaths than we do from the COVID-19. I mean, I think Massachusetts the other day surpassed 3,000. I think I saw a story in the Globe, in the Boston Globe over the weekend, and Massachusetts had surpassed 3,000 deaths. Latest report, I think yesterday, had Vermont at 48 deaths. That's a huge difference. And, you know, Massachusetts is about 11 times the population of Vermont. So based on that alone, you might expect Massachusetts to have 500 or 600 deaths. And instead, they've, you know, we're talking about six times that many. And I just wonder, you know, are we worried about having a huge COVID-19 presence still so close to our borders?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, viruses don't like pay any attention to borders. But I guess I would say two things to that. One is about the reporting of case numbers. And that has to do with the CDC, I think it was on April 13th, allowing doctors to record presumed cases, untested, unconfirmed cases among the numbers. And if you look at the numbers for that day, you know, in New York City, the case count jumped. It increased almost doubled. It increased by 3,600 cases. So, you know, I think there's some data issues with how we're counting cases. And I, you know, there were some doctors who did a press conference from Bakersfield, California, and they actually cited colleagues who are getting pressure to record death as COVID-19. You know, we know that the vast majority of folks that are dying from COVID have comorbidities. It's like in the 90, somewhere in the 90 percentile. And, you know, someone who already has pneumonia, who smoked for 25 years, who happened to, you know, have COVID or be presumed to have COVID when they died, if they're counted as a COVID death, is that really a COVID death or was it a death from pneumonia or from smoking for 25 years? You know, so there's an issue with numbers there, I think. But also, I would say, you know, just because lockdowns are lifted, people aren't going to just run out of their houses. I mean, I think people in Vermont and Massachusetts and New York who are afraid of getting COVID aren't going to, you know, they're going to be the last ones that come out. They're going to still social distance regardless of what, you know, the government says. And other people, I think, are also going to be cautious. We're not going to just all of a sudden abandon, you know, what we know about, you know, hand washing or, you know, going out when we're sick. And yes, there is this issue with when you have it and you don't know. But again, I go back to the fact that for the vast majority of people, we see very mild or no symptoms. And I think that it's out there a lot in the population more than people think anyway in the background. You know, there's a lot of people, these studies in New York and Santa Clara, California, and Los Angeles. No, they're not perfect, but the antibody studies are showing there's a higher prevalence than initially thought. So, you know, we might already be well on the path to herd immunity.
Let me bring in a couple of callers here. We have Stuart on the line. Good morning, Stuart.
Thanks, Dave. I want to start by saying I'm sad to hear the introductory remarks that an epidemiologist would make, and I would like to state some facts. When this started, this COVID-19 started, we recognized right away that it would be exponential growth, that there was no cure and no vaccine. And we had the 1918 experience, the data from 1918, which showed that a city like Philadelphia that remained open followed that high peak growth curve and overwhelmed the medical establishment, whereas St. Louis, which restricted social contact, was a flat line in terms of the way cases developed. In other words, we knew right from the start how this would expand, and we knew, this is a kind of a cliche, if social isolation is effective, it will look like we didn't need to do it. And that's kind of the message I feel like I'm hearing. We really didn't need to do it. The models were wrong. No, the models were right. So we have successfully protected the hospitals, and now you're thinking about opening up. Well, my third point is treatment for the at-risk population is not effective. Look at the number of people that have died from the use of ventilators. Ventilators is a hugely invasive procedure. They put you into a coma. They're bruising your lungs as they go in. So opening, as we open anything, we're going to put compromised and older adults at risk. And what does the population of Vermont look like? Are we 30%, 20% over 65? So there's no effective treatment if you're coming in with COPD or lung disease or diabetes, or you're overweight and you're old. So I've heard your epidemiologist say, well, the at-risk will still hide. But I'm saying if you open, then the few times that the at-risk will still need to go out, they'll be encountering a greater risk unless we maintain.
Okay. Stuart,
yeah, go ahead.
I got to move on, but I appreciate your thoughts here. I mean, I think that some of what you're presenting here is sort of the other side of the argument. And by the way, I did ask at the health department if they have someone come on and sort of present kind of the other side of the story here. Didn't get a lot of excitement from that direction about doing that. But clearly, I think the health department is of the view that we need to stick with it for a while here, folks. We need to emerge from our social isolation as we do so very carefully and slowly. The governor talks about, of course, turning the spigot. I think your headline, Amy Stevenson, was talking about opening up the spigot fully. So that spigot metaphor is being used is kind of on both sides of the debate here. Amy Stevenson, do you think that folks ought to be wearing masks in public?
Can I also just go back real quick and correct that I am not an epidemiologist? I think that's important. I am a concerned citizen.
Sure, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Some background, some expertise, because my doctorate is in microbiology. But I,
right.
There are other experts with many more credentials than me saying the same things I'm saying. I understand it's very polarizing and that, there's very different views on this. But but I don't want to come across as like some, the definitive expert on this. I am just a concerned citizen with a different point of view.
I appreciate that. And we try to welcome different points of view under the Dave Graham Show. I think that's the kind of the purpose of this conversation this morning. I want to bring in another caller, if I could. That is Elizabeth from Wheelock. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine, and you?
Pretty well, thanks.
Well,
what's on your mind?
Personally, I find the guest host speaker to be very difference of opinion, and I welcome it since it may be the first time in 6 months that we heard a difference of opinion. I understand what she's saying, and I have read similar reports, although I have not done as much research in the area as she has done. I think she's done has presented her information with clarity, with facts, and not modeling, which I agree with. And I have come to the similar conclusions as she has, as many people have. One concern I have, before you cut me off, because I do have a difference of opinion, is when we first started hearing about this whole virus epidemic, CDC said a pandemic is around 3 to 5% death rate. We are at, the best I understand it, 0.01% death rate. That does not make sense to lock up the rest of 99% of the population of 630,000 people for 0.01%.
Got it. Okay. Well, Elizabeth, I do have to move on because I got another caller, but I appreciate your thoughts. Let's go to Dick from Waterbury. Good morning, Dick.
Morning. Generally, I guess I kind of tend to agree with your guest. What would be interesting would be if they would also provide numbers, a further breakdown of numbers, say by age bracket, 0 to 15, 16 to 30, 31 to 45. So they could really get a better trend of, I mean, they know that it's in the, the elderly get hit much more difficulty than anybody else. But that might help guide them also to, okay, what can we open up? What kind of age brackets are we looking at that we can open up and maybe even have some decisions on schooling?
Got it. Okay,
and
Dick.
And the other comment was on elective surgeries. There's really, if there's been plenty of hospital beds available, if you have been wanting to get hip surgery, that's a 1 or 2 day hospital stay at the most. And, there's no reason to shut all that kind of stuff off.
Yeah, I guess it was concerned at earlier on that if the hospitals needed to really shift staff and shift facilities over to caring for a big influx of COVID-19 patients, that you might actually not have the facilities and staff to conduct some of the more routine surgeries like hips and knees and shoulders and all the other stuff, the orthopedic stuff, and back surgeries, of course, are a big, very common feature of life in Vermont. And the health officials have been urging folks that if you have a problem which you think is serious, don't be shy about stepping up. And, if you think you're having heart trouble, go to the ER. If you think you're having any other difficulties that need attention, call your doctor and get that attention. And I think they're trying to make sure that the message is calibrated properly. So,
sure, but they could identify those surgeries like hip, like hernia, that are just, in and out kinds of things. And even if there was an influx, they just shut them off.
Yeah. Yep. So, got it, Dick. I think you make a good point there. Thank you for the call. Hey, Amy Stevenson, what other kinds of reactions have you gotten to your essay? Have you heard from other folks?
Yeah, it's been, it's out there on Vermont Biz, Vermont Business's website, and a website called True North. And a lot, the overwhelming number of comments as of when I checked yesterday were positive, which I was kind of happy to see, because I know that I'm saying something that not a lot of other people are saying. So similar to the second caller who said, you know, I agree. I've been seeing positive comments.
All right. Well, Amy Stevenson, we're about out of time, but I appreciate you checking in with us this morning. Good talking with you, and best of luck to you. Stay healthy out there. Wash your hands often. And we're going to go to a bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we'll be back afterward talking to Labor Commissioner Michael Harrington about the unemployment claims system. Back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program on this Friday morning, May the 1st, 2020. And kept hearing last night about how April was the cruelest month. Let's hope May is less so, including to our unemployed workers out there around Vermont, who many of whom are really struggling. And among their struggles is trying to get through on the phone to the State Department of Labor and get their unemployment claims put in and straightened out and unconfused, or if that's a word, I don't think it is, actually. Here to talk to us about progress on that front is Commissioner Michael Harrington of the Department of Labor. Commissioner, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So give us a status report to start with. Where are we on trying to get these systems up and running at the volume that they seem to need to be running?
Yeah, so we know that there are still groups of people that are having a hard time getting through on some of our lines. I will say, though, we are seeing volumes online decrease significantly. You know, I think at one point, this came up at a previous press conference, you know, we reported, let's say, pings or hits on a line, which was, you know, it doesn't tell us how many callers, but it tells us how many times someone, a group of people dialed into a line, was in the hundreds of thousands. And we're seeing those drop now to, in some cases, 10,000 or 5,000 or 20,000. So certainly the volume of a number of people trying to get through is decreasing. But they're, you know, certainly they're running into points and periods in the day. We're also seeing where certain points of the day are very high volume, usually mornings, a portion of the midday and the end of the day. However, we are seeing other parts of the day where people are, there's less volume and people are able to get through. So there are cycles, and it is, you know, there are ebbs and flows to the volume.
So if you're somebody who's interested in calling the Department of Labor, if you were on that end of the line, what time of day would you choose right now?
Yeah, I would say Mondays are always a very busy day. And so I would say if you can find off days, usually midweek, and if you pick off periods, so again, you know, something around mid to late morning or middle afternoon, those seem to be the periods. And I should say that, you know, what we're also seeing is less volume on certain lines and higher volume on others. So we're seeing, you know, people trying to open initial claims, that volume has gone down quite a bit. Certainly, we know that with the pandemic unemployment assistance program launching at the end of last week, this week has obviously been very busy for that program. That line has seen a lot of traffic this week. So again, part of that is just based on, you know, where we are, what we're launching, what's going on, things like that.
The That pandemic assistance, give me that program title again.
Yeah, it's called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA.
Okay. And that is mainly for people who don't normally participate in the unemployment insurance program. Is that right?
Yeah. So typically there's two or three groups there. So you could say this is the people who typically don't participate in UI and don't contribute to the UI fund. So it's self-employed individuals or independent contractors, sole proprietors. The other population are a number of people out there. You have to earn a certain amount of money in a certain period of time to be eligible for traditional unemployment insurance. And mm-hmm. So there are a number of people who, you know, either started a new job and don't have a lot of wages in what we call their base period to make them eligible for general UI. But those people, for the most part, are eligible for PUA. And there's certainly certain cases that would make them ineligible. But for the most part, if you were working full time, but prior to COVID-19, but you didn't have enough wages in your base period, you would be eligible for PUA.
And that is a key consideration then, is that folks need to be aware of sort of what wages are in their base period, because this is what your situation is calculated on. I'm curious to know, part of the confusion here, I was talking to a couple of friends who actually are in situations where they were working more than one job and lost one of the jobs, keep the other job. Are they eligible for unemployment? And is there any likely confusion when they call about whether, you know, will the Department of Labor assume they've lost both jobs or what's the drill on that front, since so many Vermonters,
yeah, you and I cool. talked about this last time. Unemployment insurance is probably one of the most complex federal programs that's out there. So it creates a lot of confusion for a lot of people, and we totally understand that. Part of what we're trying to do too is take very complex systems and then try to, represent it or recommunicate it to the public in a way that makes it easier to understand. But a lot of that information is really driven by the federal government and the federal requirements. So that makes it difficult at times. A lot of people say, I don't understand this question, or, you know, why did you have to ask this question in this way on the application? It doesn't make sense. Some of that is driven by what the federal government requires us to ask for as information. In this case, like you were talking about, one of those issues are people who have multiple jobs, right? So in the PUA program, it's less about how many jobs you had and more about how much, if you are eligible for pandemic unemployment assistance, it's more based on how much did you earn in 2019 and how much work did you lose, right? So did you go from working full-time to part-time or, you know, were you working two full-time jobs, in which case if you lost one, you did have a reduction in hours, but you didn't necessarily move into the part-time category. So to be determined to be part-time, you have to be working less than 35 hours a week. And so there are a number of people who, you know, have two jobs that are part-time that makes them working more than 35 hours a week. So they would still be considered, fully employed.
I see. Okay. Talk to me a little bit about where we are currently on the efforts to beef up your staff. And also, I understand you're using an outside contractor or two to supplement the people you have available to respond to this, what's been a giant influx of calls.
Yeah. So we saw, like you said, we were managing about 3,500 cases or claims a week and on any given week prior to COVID-19, and then within the first 2 weeks of the pandemic, we were handling 80,000 cases. So certainly there's no department or state out there that could ramp up to manage that type of volume increase, within a short period of time. So we had great partnerships with some private companies out there, along with other state agencies and divisions who loaned us other staff, to the point where we ended up with roughly around 100 people on that could start relatively quickly to start ramping up our ability to assist. But when you have, you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, that's just a volume that is very hard to manage. So we also reached out to a vendor that already did work for the state in terms of call center work, and that company is called Maximus. And they have been, since their launch last week, which was on Thursday afternoon or Wednesday afternoon and Thursday morning, they've been rapidly hiring people and putting people to work on our phone lines. The thing is that there's a delay because you have to not only hire the people, but you have to train them in the system they're going to be providing guidance and support for. Right. So there is a period of time that it takes to ramp up because there is significant training that has to happen in order to administer this federal program. So as of today, I believe they've got somewhere close to 100 customer service representatives, give or take, because they do shifts and offsets. But then by mid next week, I think we're expecting to have over 150 customer service representatives on the lines just through that private vendor alone. And so we expect our ability and capability to actually double in handling like PUA claims and stuff just in the next 5 days, 6 days.
Okay. And the vendor is and your own crew are I was reading in 7 days are forced to deal with this mainframe computer that is decades old and is allegedly not in the greatest shape. How is that impinging or is it not too bad affecting the work that the department is trying to do?
Yeah, there are two things that impede our work. One is the mainframe system. So it's just very clunky. It's hard to use. It's not intuitive. And I think I gave this example for most people who know what a COBOL mainframe system looks like on the user end. You know, it's typically a screen that has different tabbed boxes that you work through and you code in numbers. And you do everything through number generation, not through typing words and information. And it's not like there are links to click on. You literally have to tab through each section and enter in codes for each section. So it's a lot like probably what medical office practices have dealt with over the past, you know, updating over the past 20 years. So that's one piece. I did ask our team, you know, when was the system implemented? And there's actually a photo on the wall downstairs that says activation of the DOL mainframe system, and it was in June of 1970. So we're talking about a system that is about to reach its 50th birthday in the next 2 months.
Wow.
So. Yeah. So again, you know, I also gave the example, this is a system like back then there were no email addresses, right? So when we talk about the ability to communicate with claimants, there's no actual spot in the system to capture an email address. You know, so we've had to figure out totally different ways to capture email addresses to be able to email a claimant information because that functionality just did not exist in our mainframe system. And then the other piece of that is just the fact that it's not as easy as just saying this person applied for benefits, therefore we pay them benefits. Again, this is there are hundreds of federal requirements and dozens of processes that have to occur on each claim. And we do our best to automate those within our systems. But at some level, this is a system that has been in place for decades at the federal level and was designed around human interaction. So even once you get through most of the process, there's still an expectation that a human is reviewing a claim and signing off on a claim. And that may be that we're doing it after the fact, which we did with a lot of our claims, but there's still that expectation. So, you know, part of this too is simply just trying to the best of our ability to meet all the federal requirements for the program, and then be able to implement the program in a way that gets people benefits quickly. And unfortunately, those two don't always match up.
Now, I understand you can file your weekly claims online. So you go to a website and fill in a form on the website, I would gather, and that then has to mesh with this mainframe in the older system, or how's that work?
Yeah, so let's talk about traditional unemployment insurance and the PUA program as two different systems.
Okay.
So there is information that is shared back and forth, but in terms of the administering of the program, they're two separate programs. So in most cases, in either case, you can file online submit your weekly claim. And essentially, you're attesting that over the course of the last 7 days, you didn't work any hours and you didn't earn any wages. And that's what makes you eligible to receive your benefit. And so you're always reporting for the week that you just got out of, not for the week you're in. So that created some confusion with claimants originally. I think we've gotten over that. But, you know, for example, it still puts the onus back on the claimant to file their weekly claim. And if they don't file their claim, we aren't able to pay them. And so I say that in case someone's listening and they didn't realize that they needed to go in and file each week, that for each week you want to receive benefits for, you have to submit a weekly certification saying you didn't earn anything and you didn't work at all during that last week. The same thing is true in the PUA program. You go online, you submit your weekly certifications. Both systems process those certifications and then issue payments to people, either through electronic, you know, direct deposit or a check.
I see. Okay. Let's go to a listener who's on the line calling in, Wade from Corinth. Good morning, Wade.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Mr. Harrington. First, I want to say, yeah, thank you for hanging in there. It's been an insurmountable task with what you've been up to over the last, you know, couple months. And for myself, my employees, it's been working relatively well. You know, with some patience, of course, and I'm in the POA. That seems to be working out okay for me too, as a self-employed. But I have a question. It's a little cart before the horse, but while you're on there, so as employees do start to come back to work, at least say somebody works 15 hours, they normally work 30, and they're getting both state and the federal frosting on the cake there that's coming through there.
Yeah.
How does that affect their benefits on a weekly basis if they start claiming, say, 50% of the hours?
Great question, Wade. Thank you, and appreciate your patience and support as we're working through this crisis. So as people begin to go back to work and they begin to receive wages, then they, on their weekly certification, need to report those wages, and the system will calculate a new monetary determination or weekly benefit amount based on what they've earned. And so if they were saying I was fully unemployed and now I'm only partially unemployed, the system will correct for that. But again, it's also based on, this is another nuance to the system. When your employees go back to work, it's based on, the work that they performed and earned, not the wages they received. So a lot of people will say, oh, well, I didn't receive my paycheck this week. I received that next week or in 2 weeks. But it's really saying, how many hours did you work this week and what did you earn this week? Not what did you receive this week?
Right. Even though they didn't, like if I get, like I pay employees bi-weekly. So they should claim the hours each week.
Yep.
And then that would just be enough. And does that, I don't want to say penalize, but does that prorate that amount out of just the state portion or the federal portion too?
At this point, it just does the state portion. So there's the state portion is traditional UI, and then there are two federal programs. So one federal program is the PUA program, which you mentioned. The additional federal program is that $600 benefit on, we'll call it a federal bump on top of the benefit that someone would be receiving. So as long as they're receiving some form of either traditional UI or pandemic unemployment assistance, they will also get the $600.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I just didn't want to, you know, start, you know, putting people back to work, you know, on a minor percentage basis and penalize them somehow their benefits.
No, I appreciate that. Yep.
Good. All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Wade, thanks for the call. Yeah, appreciate it. Hey, Commissioner Michael Harrington, I wanted to ask you also, in terms of the federal benefit, that federal bump, as you described it, $600, that frequently puts people up over what they were making in the workplace before this whole thing started, and that there's worry in some quarters that that would create, could create a disincentive for people going back to work. What do you make of all that, and what can be done to offset that if it is, in fact, a problem?
Yeah, so again, the whole premise behind unemployment insurance is that it provides wage replacement for people who are out of work due to no fault of their own. And so, you know, traditionally people don't make on unemployment what they would make during their normal jobs. And that's one, to incentivize them to go back to look for full-time work. And so they don't just sit on the system. I think in this case where, you know, employees aren't necessarily able to go look for work or go back to work, my guess would be that as the federal government was trying to determine what that looks like, they realized we need to be providing more than just the minimum, you know, the traditional benefits. We need to, because these are people who are going to rely on these benefits until the government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, tells them they can go back to work. And so that's why I think you see that federal bump there. To get to your question, though, if someone is offered work at the same rate of pay and the same number of hours that they were working prior to COVID-19, they have an obligation to accept that work unless they fall under one of the exceptions. And those exceptions are that the workplace, you know, provides undue risk or harm to them, you know, based on exposure. And that would be like if a business wasn't following guidance or wasn't following CDC protocols and so forth. Or if they were diagnosed with COVID and needed or suspected to have come in contact with somebody and were being quarantined, if they were staying home to care for a loved one who had been exposed or was in quarantine, or they were taking care of a child who was either out of school or didn't have child care. Those are the exceptions to that rule. But otherwise, if they are offered the same level of employment at the same rate of pay, they are obligated to take it. And if they turn it down, they will essentially become ineligible for benefits. And it may mean that we don't catch them right away. It may be that we catch them a couple weeks down the line. And in those cases, they would actually be required to repay any benefits that they earn during that time. The other thing I'll point out is if you're an employer out there and you're concerned about this or running into this already, where people are turning down work, there is a link on our website, and that's labor.vermont.gov. It's on the right-hand side along the column there that says refusal to return to work, and employers can click on that, and they can essentially report cases where someone refused to return to work, and we would manage that within our system. There is a mechanism for employers to let us know.
Let me ask about that federal bump, the $600, which a lot of people are, you know, say, wow, that's pretty cool. That's nice and generous. Gee whiz.
Yeah, sure.
But that actually goes away in some fairly near-term time, right? Is it late July?
Yeah, it's in July. I don't know the exact date off the top of my head, but it is in July, I think towards the mid or end of July. And that, you know, that, again, it was an incentive in the first federal relief package. I think part of that probably is because we also didn't know how long this would last. And so I always say that everything is kind of up in the air in terms of whether a federal program will continue or stop, or a new program might come out. And so we may see that, you know, just to whatever level the Congress and the president and the federal government decide that, you know, they may extend a particular benefit or they may add a new program.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to all the callers, but I wanted to bring in at least one more if it could be quick. And that's Betty from Barry. Betty, do you have a quick question?
Pretty quick. He answered most of my, Mr. Harrington answered most of my questions that I had when I had just finished listening to him. The only other one is this. If an employee is asked to go back to work and the employer has tried to get in touch with them, sent them, called them, sent them emails, what if they don't respond? Is that a refusal or is that just, you know? Just
no reply to messages from the employer, Mr. Harrington.
Yeah, again, it would depend on their situation and, you know, without knowing the details. So if they fell into one of those exemptions, you know, our hope would be that the employer would work with the claimant in this case or the employee. But, yeah, it could be considered a refusal depending on the circumstance. So, again, we'd hope that everybody will work together, but that's not always the case.
Michael Harrington, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Labor, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate it. We'll talk soon. Thank you. All righty. Going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News and more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
John? And we are back on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we appreciate you all staying with us in our second hour here. And I wanted to introduce our next guest, who is getting to be a regular on Fridays, Bob Ney, one of our longtime national correspondents here, used to be Talk Media News, and now he joins us, I think, pretty much under his own aegis each Friday. And, Bob, thank you so much for doing so today.
Thank you, Dave. Happy to be here.
And tell us about your current headlines. What do you have today? What's the big news?
Well, every week I print the coronavirus dashboard from Axios News Service, and it just shows what, you know, is current. So confirmed cases as of 7 a.m. today worldwide is 3,271,961. Total deaths, 233,704. The U.S. is 1 million cases that have been confirmed, basically 1,070,000. Total deaths, 63,019 as of today. So I always kind of start the day out with just seeing what the stats are. Obviously, they're not growing like they were when you and I talked, you know, for example, a month back on this issue. So,
yeah, I've been trying to figure out here in Vermont, we have, I think it's 866 cases right now, 10 people hospitalized, 48 people have lost their lives to this virus in Vermont. But that is a low number compared to neighboring states, including Massachusetts, which borders Vermont on the south. Massachusetts has had, as of this past weekend, I saw in the Boston Globe, more than 3,000 deaths. And, you know, you'd expect it to have a larger number. It has a larger population, but it has a larger population than Vermont by about 11 times. And yet it has, it has a much bigger disparity in the number of coronavirus cases and deaths. And do you have any sense of what people are saying about why there would be this variation between two neighboring states?
Well, you know, if you look at Ohio, we have a population of 11 million. We have 975 deaths. Now, Florida is not a neighboring state, but Florida definitely shut down way later than we did. They opened up their beaches publicly. You know, we don't have beaches. We haven't opened up our public facilities. And Florida is ahead of us by about 200 deaths. And we were one of the first states to shut everything down, including schools. So you look at that and you think, okay, why, you know, why are we not that much better compared to, you know, Florida? I think what's important to look at is the hospitalization utilization. Nobody talks about that. My local hospital, Newark, Ohio, you could shoot a cannonball through it and not injure anybody. It's been just sitting there half, you know, half empty for the last month or so. And case-wise in Newark, Ohio, probably I think we had one death, maybe two, and the hospitals are not overflowing. So I think at some point in time they have to say if Vermont or, you know, Ohio or certain parts of Ohio or whatever other state, if they aren't, in fact, you know, the hospitals aren't overflowing, then we've got to look at additional health care because a lot of our elective health care was stopped here.
Yeah, that's the case here as well. And, of course, that is that's had a big negative revenue impact on hospitals here, I'm sure, there as well. And I'm wondering, what are you hearing about that now? Is there increasing pressure out there to get the hospitals reopened?
Big time. And this is not a political thing. We have a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, and people are starting to get all over the governor. They were supporting him early on, but you have cases where people have a history, for example, of skin cancer. Something develops. They haven't been able to see a doctor for a month and a half. Well, you know, with skin cancer, a month and a half can mean the difference of your life or not. The cardiac rehab centers aren't operating. And if you've had, you know, a heart attack, I had one a year ago, you need to have, in a lot of cases, cardiac rehab. So they're deeming those to be, you know, elective, and they really aren't elective. So that's starting to hit hard here, people that haven't been able to get their kidney transplants and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's bubbling up a lot, Dave, at least in the state of Ohio. And friends I talk to across the country, it's starting to bubble up. People want, you know, and by the way, a lot of doctors have made the public statement they want to go back to treating patients.
Not only is there a push for getting the hospitals reopened, but in Michigan yesterday, there was a push to get everything reopened. And it was a pretty ugly scene there at the State House. People arriving there with guns demanding that the lockdown end. And I'm wondering, you know, is there any of that bubbling up in other states to that degree?
We had a pretty big protest in Ohio. Some of the states have had large protests. I think the one that stands out the most is Michigan because people did go armed. Michigan, by the way, they were legally armed because
COVID-19 is not.
Michigan does have a law that allows them to be actually in the state house, by the way, armed. But they showed up. Now, Michigan, if you look at the governor, what she did, the legislature said, wait a minute, we want to open certain things back up. She basically said, I've got an executive order. I'm shutting them down. She also did some things early on. For example, some weird things, forbid people to buy garden seeds to plant food, you know, if you wanted. Shut down some garden nurseries. If you had a vacation home, for example, you had to pick which house you were going to stay in. You couldn't go to both. There were some things there that probably she would have been better off not to have done. You know, it added fuel to the fire. But when the legislature said, we want to reopen, and she said no, then that caused, you know, obviously a lot of anger up in Michigan. But I must say, Michigan is one of the states that is hardest hit in the country.
Yeah, I know the Detroit area in particular has been really struggling, you know, second only to maybe certainly New York, maybe New Orleans. But it's a big issue there, much more so than in many other parts of the country. Is your sense that there is any waning here? I mean, are we getting to a point now, though, where we can say, you know, we have kind of come over the hill and we're heading on a downward slope? Or what's the general word out there about all that?
I think it is. And of course, remember that, you know, this is America. So if things go back to normal and one person gets the virus, you can bet somebody's going to ask for a shutdown. You know, this is kind of the way things have tended to work here in America. There'll be some form of panic out there and some form of non-panic. I mean, there's no set standard for this thing. But I do see, in my opinion, across, except for, well, even parts of New York, too, but except leaving New York out of this because it has so many cases, there is a kind of a attitude of slowly going back to way, you know, some things were. I think the problem is going back and how they're going to say, well, you can open a movie theater, but, you know, you got to sit 6 feet apart, or, you know, you can have a daycare center that's equipped for 75 kids. Now it's equipped for 30. Who gets to stay, who gets not to stay? I mean, all of those things are probably going to cause a lot of problems. I think the most logical thing, though, is something somebody said on my Facebook post this morning, which was, you know, for the last month, we could go all through Walmart, you know, as we wanted. This is the state of Ohio, but you couldn't go down to a little small business, which has less traffic. And that's an argument that it's a little hard for people to dispute that argument.
Yeah, there are a lot of wrinkles out there that, that kind of annoy people because they don't seem to make sense. There may be legitimate reasons for all that. I don't know, you know, in each individual case, whether these occurrences are, you know, do make sense or not, or whether it's just sort of an anomaly that nobody really thought through. But that's the kind of thing that gets zeroed in on.
Yes, and Dave, as you and I know, and at the federal level, you don't have a lot of consistency necessarily. You know, you have people saying, don't wear a mask, do wear a mask. Vice President doesn't wear a mask at Mayo, but he wears a mask going through GM yesterday. You know, so you've got all of this. The President's going to go outside Sunday at the Lincoln Memorial and have a town hall. They're asking people to not try to crowd around the Lincoln Memorial for, you know, social distancing. So I think that's kind of a sign. Obviously, the President's going outside, and, you know, you can see he's probably going to send a message on that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see exactly how all that plays. It's always fascinating to watch, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it some more probably next week. In fact, Bob Nay, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. We'll talk soon. We are going to be talking in this segment about the Vermont's court system, and which is mostly shut down these days. They are still doing some of the crucial business that has to happen in the courts, and we're going to sort some of that out and then figure out what will happen with the courts as they come back into full swing whenever that happens, because I'm hearing that there may be there's some concern, frankly, about how the influx of new filings, a lot of lawyers have motions ready to go and cases ready to file, and lots of business will be heading the court's way once they open the doors. And what are they doing to get ready for all of that? We're going to find out some of that in this next segment. I want to introduce my guests. We have with us Pat Gable. Patricia Gable is the court administrator for the state of Vermont and kind of oversees the whole judiciary system and its operations. And also with us is Dan Richardson. He is regular legal analyst on the Dave Graham Show. I'm sure most listeners are familiar with Dan. He frequently provides thoughtful insights on the court system and on the legal system in Vermont and elsewhere. And Pat Gable and Dan Richardson, I want to thank the two of you for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
Good morning, Dave. And hello, Dan.
Hi, Pat.
And I also believe we're going to be speaking with Judge Brian Grierson. He was going to be joining us this morning as well. He is the chief administrative judge for Vermont's courts, and I don't know. We don't have Judge Grierson yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if he checks in with us shortly. So let's start our conversation with just the three of us then for now. And Dan, I was talking to you the other day about just the general shape of things out there in the legal system, and you were telling me that there is some concern about you know, when we reopen the courthouse doors for general sort of standard operations, that there is going to be a big influx of cases coming in. But I want to get a status report first from Patricia Gable on just sort of where things stand right now. So let's do that first, actually. Patricia Gable, the court administrator, what are courts doing? I know they're doing some business, but most of it is on hold, basically, right?
So some of your listeners may remember, the Supreme Court did declare a judicial emergency in the middle of March. And as a result of that, all non-emergency in-person proceedings were suspended, and that includes jury trials. What the court did do was permit certain in-person proceedings to go forward that were considered emergencies. And for those, we have very restricted rules regarding participation, social distancing, and the like. Mm-hmm. And Judge Grierson and I meet every morning at 8:30. And what we do is we look at what matters are pending, what kinds of issues may be brought forward that the judges feel should be heard, and then we'll go through those, and in consultation with me, the judge will decide which of those matters goes forward and which doesn't. But at the same time that we've been on hold with so many proceedings, we're already planning for how we move back into hearing more cases. And as you know, and as your listeners know, we have to do that in the context of continued social distancing. And so we've actually developed a 10-point plan for judicial emergency recovery, which we can talk about in a little bit if you'd like. But we do have a plan for reopening as we follow the science and the policy and the governor's actions in terms of the emergency order that he's issued.
And I'm told that Judge Grierson is now with us on the phone. Good morning, Judge. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, David. Thank you for inviting me.
And let me sort of segue from Patricia Gable's summation there. She was saying that you and she meet every morning, kind of go down the list of cases that are possibly going to be heard that day and decide, yes, this one's important enough to put on despite the current mostly shutdown of the court system. These others can wait. And tell me what some of the criteria are or types of cases that you'll go ahead and hear on an immediate basis.
Well, I got on a little bit late, so I didn't hear all of what Pat had to say, but under the AO 49 order, it specifies which cases can be heard on an emergency basis. Mm-hmm. And those include, I think the most common ones are issues involving children and parent-child contact. We seem to get a lot of those requests, and many of those, of course, fall into under the emergency order, so they can be heard. Because the order spells out the types of cases that can be heard, we don't get that many requests. And the requests that come in aren't necessarily to hold emergency hearings so much as it's a case that may be coming up once we resume operations and there may be a reason to allow a telephone conference, status conference to go forward sooner rather than later. One example I can give you is I had a request where a hearing on, I won't go into the details, but it was a motion to suppress evidence in a particular case. And the motion hearing had started before the emergency period set in, and the judge in question had already heard from, let's say, two or three witnesses. There was one witness left that they had not heard from when the emergency hit, and that is not a proceeding that would normally that goes forward under the AO 49. So the request was made, can we allow a hearing to go ahead for this one remaining witness that would take less than an hour? And by doing that, that would allow the judge to complete that process and issue a decision so that when we go, the motion would be resolved before we begin operations again. And so that was an example of one that we said, yes, go ahead and complete that proceeding. And
that does sound like that was really a case that was midstream as the curtain came down, so to speak.
Yes, and we've had some of those requests and some that have asked for hearings on other matters that we've said, no, it's not. I'm looking for a true emergency, something that cannot wait. We hope to begin operations again as early as June. And quite frankly, judges and attorneys have been understanding about the need to minimize court appearances in the process. So I can't say there have been a lot of requests, Dave.
Okay. When I'm just wondering, let's assume we go back to something approaching normal operations in June. My guess is that anybody casually visiting a courtroom, as I used to do occasionally as a reporter, to take in whatever trial was happening there or hearing, it's going to look and feel different. I mean, is that a good guess on my part? And And if so, how so would you say, Patricia Gable?
So I mentioned that we have a 10-point plan for reopening the spigot, so to speak. And part of that has to do with the actual physical space of the courthouses. So the first point of our plan is to make safe spaces for judiciary staff and for all participants in court proceedings. So that really requires us to look at each building. We're in over 20 courthouses, and we have to look at each building and actually reconfigure workspaces so that staff can come back safely. And that might involve the use of transparent shields at public-facing counters, tall partitions between desks, sufficient spacing, and the like. Obviously, you know, the usual kinds of equipment you need during the pandemic and training. The second thing we'll need to do is look at how we're going to conduct jury trials in the era of social distancing. And that will, again, involve looking at buildings. Which buildings, which courthouses currently exist that could actually accommodate an in-person jury proceeding? And you'll recall that it isn't just the jury trial itself, but it's been our practice to bring in pools of potential jurors and have them go through a process of voir dire so that the lawyers can choose a jury. And so the kinds of things we've done before simply wouldn't comply with social distancing. And so we're also looking at technology. To what extent can we rely on technology for parts of an entire jury proceeding that would enable us to move forward? Judge Grierson may have some thoughts on that as well.
Judge, how do you see that all working out? What do you make of that? How would voir dire, for instance, be conducted in this new world?
Well, David, that's what we're still looking at, because it is going to vary from courthouse to courthouse. It may mean, well, first of all, we're going to have a significant backlog in all of our dockets. So the first thing we've got to do is prioritize which dockets are going to have hearings scheduled in first. And without, certainly not speaking for the court, but I mean, we've got to remember that the juvenile docket has guidelines, federal guidelines that we are supposed to be following relating to the placement of children, children in custody. Those clearly are the cases that are going to take a priority over not only within that division, but within the courthouse. I mean, those matters have to be resolved. The jury trials are going to take a while longer to process, because it is going to vary, as Pat said, from courthouse to courthouse in the physical space. It may mean looking at the cases on a jury list and deciding among those which ones we have to prioritize. And we have some people that are being held without bail that have a priority. And on those cases, it may mean, for instance, you may bring in a panel in the morning, a smaller panel than we normally do. It's not uncommon to have 50, 60, 75 people called in for a jury drawing. We may have to reduce that and bring in, maybe 20 people if we have the physical space to social distance in the morning and go through a voir dire with them, and then bring back again another part of that panel in the afternoon. In other words, on days when we used to be able to pick maybe three trials, four trials in a day, we may be down to one or two trials on a draw, and we may have to split up the panels just to get those two juries drawn.
Wow, it'll slow the process down. We could talk more about that after the break, and I also want to bring in Dan Richardson to find out what he's hearing from the bar out there, from the practicing attorneys who are chomping at the bit to get back into court and get about their business. So we'll be going to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Judge Brian Grierson, Pat Gable and Dan Richardson. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back shortly.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and thanks for staying with us. We're talking with Judge Brian Grierson, the Chief Administrative Judge of the Vermont Court System, and Patricia Gable is the Court Administrator, and Dan Richardson is an attorney based in Montpelier, a former president of the Vermont Bar Association, frequent commentator on legal affairs here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Before we resume our conversation with these three excellent guests, though, I wanted to mention that at the top of the hour, just after the end of the Dave Graham Show, we are going to be going to a news conference, live coverage from WDEV of the news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials, updating us on the latest in the state's efforts to respond to the coronavirus, easy for me to say, coronavirus crisis here in Vermont. And certainly they have been quite forthright about holding news conferences pretty much every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in recent weeks. Today, of course, being Friday, we'll have one today, and go to that just live right after the top of the hour CBS News on WDEV, FM, and AM. So stay tuned for that. Don't touch that dial, as they say. Let's get back to our conversation with our three folks from the judicial system here. And let me actually bring in Dan Richardson and ask you, Dan, what are you hearing from lawyers just in general out there about are folks getting concerned that access to the courts is pretty restricted these days? Or are people being is patience the byword? Or what's going on out there?
You can imagine with a diverse group of lawyers, there's a lot of different opinions running through. I can say that, Judge Grierson's comment earlier where he said a lot of lawyers haven't been sort of, running against the barricade, demanding a hearing, is not an accident. I think there's been a lot of discussion about, what can we do to serve our clients and, work within the confines of what the court has laid down. And so as a result, I think, people have been very thoughtful about what they have put forward and tried to, sort of discern, is this really an emergency? Is this something where I have to get before the court? Or is this something where, it's going to cause my client pain? But, given the circumstances, this is where we have to be. So a lot of people have been sort of, wringing their hands trying to work through that particular set of decision tree issues. But a lot of lawyers as well are starting to look to, well, what does it look like when we reopen? And I know, for example, the probate listserv, there was a discussion started about what type of cases should be heard first. Because in probate, you have obviously wills and trusts, but you also have guardianships. And a number of people were saying those are the ones that have to go first because those are the ones that are most critical. Because in a probate will or a trust, there's probably a dead person involved who, doesn't have to work on a time frame. Whereas a guardianship, you are talking about, a live person whose care and needs are ongoing. So I think a lot of the lawyers are taking this very seriously and trying to find ways to work within the system. But, it's building. It's been, almost 2 months since most of us have had an opportunity at court time, and we have clients that have to make decisions. So I had a colleague actually who was trying to sort of game this out in terms of a claim for a client that could be brought as a civil claim or the Attorney General's office or possibly a criminal investigation. And in each case, they tried to figure out, well, what's the route that's going to get us into a court or a hearing, where I can get my clients issues before a judge the quickest. And so I think there's a lot of, thoughtful preparation. And one plug I would put into if
the court administrator's office is coming up with a, you know, a 10-point plan for how to reopen the courts or how they do it. I would strongly urge the court to talk to lawyers for ideas, because I know that, you know, there's been a lot of thoughtful conversation about that. And how do we do jury trials? How do we do, you know, I think the Zoom hearing is here to stay, especially if it's a non-evidentiary hearing. You know, why expose people? And I think a lot of lawyers would support that, and certainly they all have the tech competence to do that. But if the court's planning on something, I think it's going to be really important that lawyers be, you know, involved and give some feedback, because I think they'll have a number of thoughtful contributions to make.
Do you think that lawyers have been brought in enough so far, or are you sort of saying that hasn't been happening as much as you would like to see, and we need to step that up?
Well, part of it is, you know, and this is understandable, is that the court has been making a lot of these decisions, like the administrative order 49 that Judge Grierson referred to earlier. You know, that is something that the court had to do and had to impose and had to think about. And a lot of the things that Pat Gable was talking about, such as, you know, how court staff interact and how they are organized, that's the court. I mean, there's no, I don't think lawyers are going to be involved in how court, or should be involved in how court staff are spaced out, you know, behind the wall there. But to the extent that we're talking about how hearings flow, how jury draws are conducted, how, you know, hearings are scheduled, what's given priority or not, you know, I think it sounds very much, and that, you know, this is at the initial stages from the court planning point of view. So I certainly won't say, you know, we should have been brought in long before. That this is just starting. I think we're all kind of reacting. But I guess it's just a plea and a petition to include us as it does go along, because I think, you know, we can make thoughtful contributions to it. And before an order is issued as a final order, it's always good to get sort of a litmus test from attorneys as to, you know, what is this going to work for us? Is this sensible, you know, and in our client's best interest, or are there things that, you know, are missing or can be added and make it better? So that's just all. And I, you know, I think a lot of it is, you know, the court runs itself and it administers its own programs, but at the same time, you know, we are the main customers of judicial services as a bar. And
sure.
And so it's a dialogue, or a dialectic if you're Hegelian.
Okay. Well, you know, I must say it's probably tough right now to stop by the courthouse and file all that in the form of a motion. So I'm glad to help out here on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV-FM. Anyway, but Patricia Gable, what did you think of that last set of remarks by this petitioning attorney?
So I agree with Dan that as the court looks at, for example, which kind of cases should be rolling out first along the lines of the priorities that Judge Grierson was talking about, that the bar must be involved. And in fact, that is part of the Supreme Court's plan as it starts to look at including more cases to be heard. The 10-point plan I was talking about actually was more along the lines of what we need to do that requires funding. And as you know, the state of Vermont received a grant for $1.25 billion, and that's intended to address specifically the COVID-19 emergency. And so that's been on a very tight time frame. And so last week we needed to develop items that we need funded in order to be able to open up the court system. And along the lines of what Dan was saying, another part of the 10-point plan is to get the remote technology in place to support court proceedings. And so you can understand that with 14 units of the Superior Court, one in each county, and multiple buildings in some of those counties, for us to do remote proceedings, we need not only technology in those buildings supporting judges who conduct hearings on what's called WebEx, it's one of those platforms, but in order to provide public access to court proceedings, we also need to live stream them. And so we do not, at the moment, have the technology that permits us to do that. We have been piloting things, and this is, if there's a silver lining to the terrible crisis we're facing, it's that in real time, we've had to develop experiments and pilots. And it isn't just the court who is a participant in that, but all the parties and lawyers involved in the proceedings are also participants in a kind of experiment. And just to give you an example, what we've learned is that we have pretty reliable technology available to us in the court. And for people who are on the state system, so to speak, they can participate pretty well. But we have people participating in hearings who are not on the state system. And so part of what we need to do is to make sure that there's enough technology and there is enough support staff to provide access to justice equally to all those participants. And so remote technologies is key to being able to hear more cases. Likewise, in addition to court hearings, we have a lot of services that we are either obligated to provide for constitutional or legal reasons, or it's best practice to provide. And in particular, I would mention, I think it's true that lawyers are key customers, if you will, of the judiciary, but actually most of our cases involve people who are not represented by lawyers. And so we have the same obligation to those people to provide access even in a time of remote technologies. One of the things we're doing is seeking funding to support additional resources so we can answer phone calls for courts around the state centrally to make sure that the issues that people have are heard in real time. And we're going to be supported in that by the fact that our electronic case management system is now in the process of rollout, which makes that much easier to do because people who are answering those calls can actually go in and see those cases. We also owe responsibilities to people who for them, English is not a first language. And we're required and are happy to provide court interpretation and translation services. And so we will need to be able to do video remote interpreting, for example. And we're also considering whether or not, and this is where an area where the bar will be very important, should we start to host online dispute resolution capability? And of course, we wouldn't move forward on that without consultation with the bar.
Let me ask about sort of alternative dispute resolution, Dan Richardson. Is there any sort of change in practice recently where more cases are being sort of settled out of court these days, or because the courts are less available, or has that not really taken hold yet?
Well, I don't know if I have any data to support a rise or not, but there's two things I think that have arisen as a result of this. Is one, you know, it just plays into the economic factors of how you settle, which is if you know that you're going to have to wait to get in front of a judge, you know, until the other side of, you know, this crisis, and then maybe some time beyond that because there are going to be other cases in line ahead of you, that factors in because that means that's time, and time is money in a lot of situations. And so, you know, whereas your client's bottom line was, you know, this number, it's going to go a little bit lower because, you know that even if you settle for less, that's still better than if you have to wait 4 or 5 months. You know, in that respect, I think it is leading to settlements just simply because it's another pressure that's pushing parties towards settlement if money is the factor. If it's not, you know, I know there are a number of cases out there where money is not necessarily the factor and they aren't settling, but they weren't going to settle probably anyway. But the other big rise is that, you know, a lot of mediators are adapting to the situation and doing online mediation through Zoom. And a lot of times what they do is use multiple Zoom platforms to have a virtual mediation. So you know, you and your client will log on to one Zoom account, the mediator will come on and then log out and go to the other Zoom account where the other side is sitting there, and basically have these conversations back and forth in real time. And I know one mediator, for example, I think Jim Spink up in Burlington has had at least a dozen of these mediations in this format. Mm. And I know Michael Marks and Tad Powers down in Middlebury have done similar. So, you know, this is something where people are adapting. Now, I don't know what the success rates are of those online mediations, if they're as compared to sort of the in-person mediations. But, I mean, they're successful enough that I think the mediators are continuing to push them forward, and lawyers are agreeing to participate in them. So I think it's something where, you know, dispute resolution moves on. And anytime, you know, there's all these pressures on cases and all these factors that lead to settlement. And certainly this court pressure is putting additional pressure on to say, you know, we know we're not going to settle or, you know, resolve this through the court system because of the circumstances in the near future. So let's do something to get it resolved. And then, so I think it does spark creative thinking as well.
Judge Brian Grierson, I wanted to go back to something you said just before the break at the bottom of the hour. We were talking about perhaps having to take a somewhat slow cooking approach here. I don't know exactly. Maybe that's a bad metaphor, but fewer cases in the course of a day, because, for instance, voir dire would be slower and a little more cumbersome in an age of social distancing and so on. My impression all along has been that the court system in Vermont, like a lot of other states, is already bending a bit under its workload. You know, it's not it hasn't been an easy life for you folks previous to COVID-19. If all of a sudden we're in a situation where, you know, we've got to handle fewer cases just because things are a bit more socially awkward, shall we say, what kind of effect do you think that's going to have overall?
Dave, clearly you use the term getting back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when the court system will get back to normal. We are obviously a people-oriented process, and that's what COVID-19 is. It's where it's having the impact on mm-hmm. the ability of people to get together, to be together, and that's the only way we can operate. Having said that, there are some things we're learning through this process because we had to get up to speed quickly, and by that I'm referring to the use of video, the use of audio, remote proceedings that we've been forced to use over the last 6 weeks, that I hope that we can continue to use those where it is appropriate. And for instance, we have just recently been able to set up a system involving mental health evaluations where the doctors can interview the individuals involved remotely. It's done with the collaborative effort of the Department of Mental Health, where the doctors are situated, with the defense attorneys bringing their clients, and by the court providing a space within the courthouse to allow these evaluations to take place. This is just one example of something we've had to come up with that I think we should continue after we get back to, I'll say, beginning the resumption of normal operations. It's going to take a while. There are going to be backlogs. There's no question. And that's why I was saying earlier, we've got to prioritize the cases that we're going to hear. And we were under a lot of pressure beforehand, and we will continue to be so. But I think, you know, we can take some of the procedures that we've had to develop, continue to use those, and find perhaps a new normal to process many of these cases through the system.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know when I was talking with Pat Gable, you last month, I remember you saying that that we had suddenly had to accelerate something. I remember thinking later it was kind of like you stick your toe in the water and then all of a sudden you have to dive in for whatever reason. And that's been kind of the experience here with electronic systems as applied to the court procedures. Did I recall that part of our discussion previously? Close to right.
It's another silver lining for us in a tough time. You'll recall that we've been for many years building an electronic case management system because in the courts that don't yet have it, which is most of our courts, our files are still paper files. And that restricts the ability of people to work on them to be where the paper is. And so we had just the week before Judge Gerson and I issued a memo starting to restrict proceedings because of this pandemic coming down on us. We had celebrated the rollout of our electronic case management system project in the trial courts through our pilot region, and the pilot region is Windsor, Windham, and Orange. And so unlike the other courts throughout the state, judges in that region can actually continue to work their files because even though they may be working remotely, they can access the case management system and the documents that are in the system remotely. One of the priorities of the judiciary is to continue on track with that project so that in the fall we will roll out two other regions, and that will mean then, once that is complete, that more courts than not will have access. And that's a key to being able to provide services, notwithstanding the social distancing required and the possible retrenchment. So, you know, most people are hoping that with the good news in Vermont about a drop in the incidence of COVID-19, there's an opportunity for us to bring back some more in-person proceedings, but we also know that there's a possibility we may have to retrench again. And so the ability of judges and staff to access case files remotely will be a tremendous improvement in terms of trying to work through backlogs. And the one other thing I would mention about backlogs, and Judge Gerson can talk a little bit more about his plans for this, but we're also considering inviting retired judges back and training them in the new technology, not all retired judges, but a few who've been active to continue helping out with cases. And that's part of our funding request, is that we, for a temporary period, get funding for retired judges and additional staff to work cases. And so a number of these things depend on our being able to spend some of those emergency monies.
Well, it sounds like let me just do one conclusory question for the three of you, actually, and I quickly take a turn. There's a couple minutes left. I'll start with you, Pat Gable. Do you feel like the courts are going to be able to get back to about the level they were in terms of guaranteeing people's constitutional rights and access to justice, and that justice will continue in this new world?
One of the wonderful things about the people who work in the judiciary is that they are mission driven, and it's incredible how hard people work and how committed they are to the constitutional imperatives that it's our job and our branch to hold up. So I do believe we will be able to continue to uphold constitutional rights and to do the work necessary to protect the vulnerable in society. But the way we do it may look quite different from the way we did it before.
Dan Richardson, your thoughts?
No, I don't think we're going to get to normal this year. I mean, I think some of these things are going to linger. And, you know, we're going to, like I said, Zoom is here to stay. And, you know, I certainly think from a bar's perspective, we're expecting you know, things not to just suddenly ramp up and come back to normal.
A bumpy ride. I got to interrupt, Judge Gerson, your last thought on this.
Well, I wasn't able to hear anything that Dan said, so I can't say whether I agree with him or disagree with him.
you agree.
So I'll just, to be safe, I'll say I agree with him to keep a good relationship with the bar. But
All right.
I hope we can come out of this. I mentioned it earlier, Dave. All of the individuals involved, whether it's the Bar Association, Defender General, State's Attorneys, Attorney General,
Judge, I hate to do this, but I've got to interrupt. We're about out of time.
Everybody's working together, and we're going to continue to do that to make this work.
Thank you very much, the three of you. That's about it for the Dave Graham Show today, folks. Sorry about the rushed ending there. Have a good afternoon, and we'll talk to you all on Monday.